The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, March 13th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ryan Grimm, Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept, will be here. Also on the program today, McConnell decides to cancel vacation as Dems trying to fix the economy and deal with the C word. Meanwhile, Fed's attempt to bail out Wall Street with $1.5 trillion of free loans. Huge roadblocks to testing across the country as everything begins to close. Meanwhile, this is a great idea. Unlike in the wake of 9/11 and other disasters or catastrophes, Trump blocks states from using Medicaid to respond to the C word crisis. Ohio estimates 100,000 cases of C word in their state, although just a handful have been diagnosed. And Matt Gaetz, assuring us that his test came back positive, decides to take a paid leave from Congress, even though he is vehemently against the concept of paid leaves.
He's also come a long way since making a joke about it by wearing a gas mask.
I know it.
He's learned.
Came back negative.
His test.
Yeah.
I said negative.
You said positive.
I did?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. His test, I should say, supposedly came back negative, but in an abundance of caution, just in case the test was wrong, I guess. He's taking paid leave. And speaking of a test coming back positive, Bolsonaro. How did he say it? Is that the way he said it?
Bolsonaro.
Bolsonaro. Now I can't even say it right.
Bolsonaro.
Bolsonaro. Reportedly test positive for the C word. Donald Trump apparently freaking out. A video of them hugging. U.S. strikes in Iraq following rocket attacks. Reports that another top Iranian general killed. The Georgia governor, Kemp, cancels a Supreme Court election and decides it'd just be easier if he appoints him. Chelsea Manning released from jail in the wake of her attempt at self-harm. House passes a measure limiting Trump's ability to start a war with Iran. And Democrats and Senate all trying to figure out if they're going to actually provide any relief to American citizens, or is it just better to subsidize Donald Trump's favorite businesses. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. It has been a crazy 48 hours in terms of like really fundamentally changing over the past 72 hours, I guess. Really, we have really fundamentally changed what we're talking about here. I mean, Ryan Grimm will join us ostensibly to talk about the primaries. But over the past couple of days, you know, it's become clearer that the primaries have moved off the front page. Now, Bernie Sanders still in it. or at the very least, you know, his campaign is still officially on. The debate is going to happen Sunday night. And I think it's going to be, well, we'll talk about this with Grimm. I mean, I think it's going to be a very good opportunity for Sanders to lay out a vision of how society could look like and how that would implicate things like this, but probably also how things like this indicate just how connected we are in this society and how much we rely on each other. And in an event like this, you also get a very clear picture of, you know, how things shake out when you have this type of inequality in our society. It's unclear what's going to happen in New York. There's a lot of rumors going on about Bill de Blasio just declared a state of emergency. That just gives him certain powers. We're not seeing any real direct impact. But people who can afford to get out of the city are leaving. The building that we're in, apparently, is sort of like a ghost town, according to the folks who work here.
It's the Overlook.
The
Shining reference.
That's right. But also, look, the schools right now in New York City, we have no way of knowing. Is it too early to shut them down? But when we say too early, right, what are we talking about? We're talking about, like, are they going to lose a couple of weeks worth of school that they didn't have to? Because there seems to be inevitability that we're going to have to shut down the schools in New York City. The problem is that depending on whose numbers you believe, I've seen reports up to, New York Times had a piece recently saying that over 100,000 kids, remember, New York City public schools, I think, is like 1.5 million kids. Over 100,000 of those kids are homeless. And even more of the students in this city, I don't know if it's 500,000, rely on the schools for lunch and breakfast. And presumably their parents are the last people who are allowed to take time off or not work at work. Right? People in the service industries. And so these are the people who are most susceptible to getting the virus. They are the people who have least amount of means to deal with their children if there's no school. So we have a situation where the fact that we have this type of poverty, that this type of nutrition deprivation, as it were, is going to keep us from protecting all of society from this illness. And it's going to have cascading effects. Like, this is the moment you can see it, right? This is the canary in the coal mine scenario. You bring the canary in the coal mine because they have the smallest lungs. And if there's a problem in there, you're going to see it very quickly. When we have an incident like this, when we have a phenomenon like this, you quite clearly see who are the most vulnerable in our society. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, that hackneyed slogan, "We are as strong as our weakest link," is true. And sometimes it takes an event like this to make it very, very explicit. Because we have this kind of poverty in this city, we can't close the schools without creating maybe even bigger problems. But by not closing the schools, even though kids are not affected, they're carriers, it could very well end up making people across, you know, all elements of society ill. But yet, it is still easier if you are wealthy in this society to deal with this. You can afford to pay for babysitting if you need to go to work. You can afford to get out of the city and go into a less dense area. You can afford, they've jacked up the prices on toilet paper. Okay. I mean, this is an opportunity at the very least to discuss those things. It's also an opportunity to sort of point out the importance of something like Medicaid, why you wouldn't block grant it. In other situations like this, where the economy is hit hard, and the economy is going to get hit hard here, folks, where there's a natural disaster, Medicaid, because it is not block granted, because there is not a fixed amount that each state gets, but rather a formula where the federal government can sign off if a state says, hey, you know, for whatever reason, we have an expansion of need. And this is how we can show it mathematically. And then the federal government signs off for it. We have a federal government that's just looking to cut Medicaid by block granting it. And so if they acknowledge that the system works best this way and can provide for as many people who need it this way, at least to some extent, right? I mean, some states have limited it. Then it undercuts their argument to block grant it. And so they're going to deny. So that's where we're at now. The debate as of now is going to go on. We'll talk more about it with Ryan Grimm. Just a style note, part of the style guide. We've obviously been talking about the C word quite a bit because that's implicating everything right now in our politics and in our news. And I don't get, look, this is, and on YouTube, their algorithm is such that they look at this stuff and because they don't want to hire human beings to decide whether something might be, you know, inappropriate for advertisers, they just pick keywords or they, we're not really sure what it is that they do. We don't know if they look at the transcripts or they do titling or whatever, the descriptions.
The chat.
It could be the chat. And they decide not good for advertisers. So, like, we're running at an incredibly high rate now with our videos where they are not being monetized. I get it to some degree. Part of the problem is just like Google's business model is such that they would rather not have to pay real people to look at this and make a real assessment. I think there's a broader problem, frankly, in terms of like what it means for our news going, you know, forward. A lot of people get their news from YouTube now. And if you're telling creators like you better not talk about the C word, because if you talk about the C word, we're going to demonetize you. Now, fortunately, here we have members who support the show. And we have advertisements that come from other places. And so we have multiple revenue streams. So we're not, you know, that dependent on YouTube. And I try not to like get out ahead of our skis here and grow too quickly. I'd like to, but I just don't want to, you know, we have the AM Quickie and we're, you know, financing that out of the Majority Report. So it's not that big of a disaster, but we're going to use the C word instead of the other word for this event that is affecting the United States right now and the world. So we're going to just avoid using that word. And I hope you understand what that is and whatnot. I mean, if we end up getting demonetized anyways, then we'll probably revert and just, you know, suck it up for a while. But I'm not going to stop talking about it because
it'd be difficult to find content for the show these days.
It would be difficult to find content, but also it's sort of like, you know, I'm not going to let the algorithm of YouTube and how many clicks we get, how much money we can make from it dictate what our programming is.
We're not.
And right, we've changed the company policy, so we're not going to do that anymore. But we expect, look, and, you know, we're going to take some phone calls. We didn't get a second guest today because I want to hear from people around the country as to like, you know, what's happening in their communities, about this, because, you know, I've talked to some people who are just like, yeah, what's up? I'm like, what do you mean? What's up? You know, what's up? And they're like, what do you mean? What's up? Like, there's no toilet paper in New York City. There's, you know, secret stash at Target. And, and they're just like, what? What are you talking about? You know, like, I'm curious what's going around. Now, obviously, we live in one of the densest part of the country, if not the most dense part of the country. And so there's people are at a higher concern as they're coughing in the background. And
it's a tense situation.
It's a tense situation. And and I anticipate, you know, I'm setting up situations where remote stuff. I've got family in Massachusetts who need to be cared for. And are in the, you know, that the most vulnerable category. So, you know, I'm prepared to, I've got a couple of contingencies, one which involves like a satellite studio, one which involves just sort of like a mobile studio. We're going to continue on no matter what. We are officially going down to necessary personnel only program, which we had instituted some years ago, proper the necessary person protocol at the Majority Report. A lot of people are going to be, I think, working at home and hanging out at home. Kids are going to be at home. We're going to try and, I don't know, we'll try and get creative in terms of what we can provide for people in terms of content. We'll obviously continue to do what we're doing. We're going to have to, you know, we'll see. Next week, you know, we intend to more or less be doing as we do, but at one point, it's just going to be harder to, you know, the some elements of the show are going to suffer a little bit, I think. But also, good time to take advantage of this opportunity. Majority Report is made possible in part by Skillshare. I've talked about this many times. The first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majorityreport6 are going to get a free premium membership to Skillshare for an entire 2 months. So, you know, one of the ways you look at something like these type of events is you make the most of it. And if you've not been to Skillshare, you should check it out. It's an online learning community, offers thousands of classes on almost any topic you can imagine. All the classes are taught by experts in their field. They got classes on drawing, they got classes on painting, on video editing, on things like web design, on running a small business, photography, entrepreneurship, you know, freelance stuff. Almost all the classes are less than an hour long. Every class is split up into like chapters or episodes, however you want to refer to it. And so that you can watch, like, oh, I'm going to watch two or three now, and then I'm going to go, I don't know, see if I can get buy some toilet paper down at the local store, and then I'll come back. I'll watch like three more. Everyone can benefit from setting aside a little more time to get creative, and you may have a lot more of that time going forward. Skillshare has classes for every skill level. So if you want to get better at something that you're already doing, or you want to try something for the first time ever, Skillshare is for you. A membership to Skillshare is less than 10 bucks a month. It gives you access to their entire library of classes. Look, you're at home. Some people are going to go through some very difficult financial times going forward. Good time to try and maybe, I don't know, figure out some other skills or something, you know. We're going to be talking about this a lot going forward. And one of the things that's really important when you are faced with these type of situations is that you do not let the difficulties like overtake your ability to move forward in some way. Obviously, there's real material hardship that people are going to go through. But I'm talking just about mentally. You got to just make sure you're paying attention to not letting yourself get too caught up in despair, just because you're going to need your full faculties, picking up a couple of skills here or there, making yourself just feel better in terms of just like what your knowledge is going to be really important. And this is going to be free for 2 months. This is for the first 500 people. Go to skl.sh/majorityreport6, free membership for 2 months. The link is underneath this video. If you're watching on YouTube, it is there. If you are listening on the podcast description, and take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ryan Grimm right after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program The Intercept's Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief. And apparently also working from home today, Ryan Grimm. Hello, Ryan.
How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Pretty nuts. I think I texted you, I don't know, when was this? I guess Tuesday to come on the program today, ostensibly to talk about the primary, you know, race that's going on. And it seems pretty stunning how much that has dropped off the mm-hmm. in terms of coverage and just in terms of like in the forefront of people's minds in just these 3 days.
Yeah, I was booked to go on CNN yesterday to talk about this primary. And as I was contemplating whether or not I even had the fortitude to walk through the corona swamp, that must be the DC CNN studio. They reached out to say we're canceling because we're doing, you know, wall to wall coronavirus coverage. I said, so sounds great. Because also, if you think about the CNN studio, that's the place where you would have people who would drag themselves out of their kind of isolation chamber and into the CNN studio because they just can't resist being on cable television. That's going to be a problem for every politician and every, you know, anchor and correspondent who appears on Fox, MSNBC, CNN. How do you keep those places clean?
Yeah, I was booked to be on MSNBC this morning. I rarely do this, but it was an opportunity for me to go up against some former Joe Manchin chief of staff or something who mm-hmm. is the ED or something of a big tent pack, which was set up exclusively for the purposes of defeating Bernie Sanders, oddly enough.
Yeah, keeping the tent small.
And yeah, exactly. And dark money. Very, very dark money mm-hmm. That is supporting that. And I was actually looking forward to it, but I also knew like they're going to cancel. They're mm-hmm. not talking about it at all at this point. And to a certain extent, it doesn't feel like, right? I mean, from Biden's perspective, that's fine, it seems right to me. And it doesn't feel like the Sanders campaign is, and again, it would be hard to know, right? Just by looking at cable news, mm-hmm. but it doesn't feel like they're making a huge effort to break through this, and understandably so. It seems to me like my sense is that the broad appetite for a continuance of a contentious primary just seems to be minimized at this point. Basically since Trump got on air and said, we're all doomed.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's right. And also you have the calendar where Bernie's up against four states where he got clobbered in 2016, even as he had some momentum. And there's no reason to think that, that he would do better this year, except for the fact that you can't know anything because right. you don't know who's going to show up, if anybody's going to show up. But I think you're right. And I think what's fascinating about Trump's lack of leadership is that he made his lack of preparedness and his manifest inability to handle this crisis so apparent that it triggered in millions of people around the country the impulse to take action on their own. Like it was like the opposite of leadership, but it had the effect of galvanizing the entire population. Because university presidents, the heads of the NBA, NHL, et cetera, the local leaders all realized in an instant, we are on our own. Like there is no leadership here.
It really was amazing.
It
was like literally we're like everybody's on the, on the Poseidon, or you know, we're all on, you know, I'm thinking of the Poseidon Adventure, which of course is not the, not a real boat, but we're all on this boat headed towards an iceberg. And the first time we hear from the captain, it's from a dinghy as he's like, you know, going off, and everybody's like, wait a second. Oh man, we better do something here.
Yeah.
And it has been.
Captain doesn't have this.
Right. Captain doesn't have this. It was nice of him to come out and announce that. Like, I just want everybody to know, if you've been waiting on me, I just want to make it clear, like, not happening. But let's keep a little bit of focus on the primary just for a moment. So Sunday night, they're going to have this debate, right? And it seems to me, as far as I can tell, you know, based upon both of their speeches. They both gave speeches. I thought Sanders gave an excellent speech in terms of like expressing how this whole scenario reinforces what his agenda is in something. Like this scenario is like explaining what the need for his agenda.
Yeah.
Biden came out and I think, you know, offered essentially like, you know, let's address this, you know, narrow issue here and that narrow issue here. It was completely unambitious, but it was at least
on brand for Biden.
On brand for Biden. And, you know, at the very least, he wasn't, you know, coming out and saying it was really the Europeans' fault. So don't worry about this. It won't hurt you.
It's a foreign virus.
Exactly. It's a foreign virus, so it doesn't count against me, so everybody's fine. it seems to me what we're going to see, and Sanders indicated even prior to Trump's speech that he was not, I think this was on Fallon, that he was not going to make the argument that Biden can't win. Did you pick up on that, Fallon
appearance? Yeah, I did. And you know, there's some... You know, at this point, you know, what's the upside in him saying the opposite? Because, A, he's the motivated speaker. Like, even if he does say Biden can't win, doesn't mean people are going to walk away from hearing that and say, well, Bernie says Biden can't win, so I guess I better support Bernie. You know, Bernie had been making the case for a year that he was the more electable candidate in the pack. And there were weeks where the national Democratic primary electorate agreed with him, according to polls. And, you know, as a result, he was the front runner for a while, you know, losing chips away at that feeling. And so, you know, he can say it all he wants, but it doesn't mean that people are necessarily going to believe it. And also, the pandemic suggests that if Biden survives, he probably can beat Trump.
Right.
You know, Trump might be at 20% approval rating by November.
Yeah.
You know, we just have absolutely no idea what's going to happen over the next several months. And if the scenario that's unfolded in Italy happens here, then, you know, the Republican Party is going to utterly turn on Donald Trump. You saw Ben Shapiro, you know, already upset that there aren't enough tests. Like, you know, as somebody said, you know, we're all democratic socialists in a crisis. You know, they're willing to ride or die. You know, they were willing to ride or die with Trump as an expression, but not literally.
Right.
And so that will be the end of the ride for Trump if that's what happens. And if I'm Biden, I just sit in my living room and don't let anybody interact with me for 9 months because you know, awful on the trail. He just shouts at people and tells them to vote for somebody else. He forgets what office he's running for. He forgets who, you know, he's served under. When he met with newspaper editorial boards, they would go into that meeting obviously inclined to endorse Joe Biden. Like, you know, who is a better demographic for Joe Biden than newspaper editors and their readership, old people? And they would come out and come up with some convoluted nonsense and endorse somebody else, whether they endorse two people. The state in South Carolina actually endorsed Pete Buttigieg. You know, their readership is probably more than half African-American. And they were so, you know, disturbed clearly by their meeting with Joe Biden that they endorsed Pete Buttigieg. Des Moines Register did Warren, the Manchester papers did Klobuchar, New York Times endorsed several people. Everybody doing whatever they could not to endorse Biden. You know, when you would interview people coming out of events in Iowa that where Biden had spoke, they'd be like, I went in a Biden supporter and I came out looking for somebody else. So just politically, it benefits him to be off the campaign trail.
Absolutely.
But health-wise, it would too.
Yep. Well, that is the benefit here is that, you know, as opposed to, you know, we were seeing reports of they're going to hold Biden back. They're not going to let him out. You know, this is before any of this happened. And
right. They already wanted to do that.
And they already wanted to do that. And the risk was, of course, that Trump is going to be out there doing these rallies going like, Sleepy Joe, just doing one event a month. What's going on, Joe? Are you okay? Should I send the doctor over? And now the campaign has obviously like, it would be irresponsible for them to send him out. And that conversation is just simply not going to happen. It's just taken for granted. And I want to make something clear here because I'm going to get a bunch of emails from people going like, you're helping Donald Trump by, you know, talking about the Joe Biden's frailties. First off, they are what they are. Donald Trump does not need Ryan Grimm and Sam Cedar talking about this to know that there's some fertile territory there. If you think that, then you should also think that there's no way that Donald Trump can't be defeated, because if he didn't know this stuff before we're mentioning it, then he's got a real problem. But the reality is it's going to be less it's going to be less obvious to the remainder of the Democratic vote. I mean, this comes down to the endorsements, because it feels like to me, like, as you say, whenever Joe Biden got out there in any type of legitimate fashion where people actually experienced him firsthand, they walked away, whether it was newspapers or whether it was people at rallies, like you say, or whether it was reporters, they walk away going like, this ain't going to work, folks. And clearly the Democratic establishment knew that, because they would have endorsed him 6 months ago. And so it only became this moment where everybody was like, Sanders is going to be the nominee, when people were like, we would rather have this guy who we don't, you know, voters don't seem to be responding to, and, you know, the would be endorsers don't seem to be responding to. And Clyburn gets on board, and then Obama calls Pete Buttigieg and apparently just says, you know, this is your peak leverage, winky, winky. And then it just like the floodgates open. So that gave the signal to voters who were, I think, out there going like, you know, 65% of them are voting for the person they think who can win, not based upon the issues they agree with. That's what the polling told us, like out of Michigan and a couple other states. And they're just looking for a sign. And why wouldn't you trust the other people running with him? Who else is there?
Right. If Klobuchar, if Buttigieg, if Clyburn, if the whole establishment is telling you that, you know, this guy, don't worry about it. You know, we're actually okay with him. Forget the last year where we signaled that we didn't think that Biden had what it took to get over the finish line. He's fine. Trust me, he's going to be fine. Then as a voter, you're like, okay, well, if you say so,
yeah,
you know better than me. Let's do it.
So let's talk about the only thing that, and this was my feeling after Super Tuesday, there was only one thing. And again, we still have this debate. And I don't think Bernie is going to go hard at Biden in this debate. I think Bernie's just going to go, you know, just present his program, his vision, and let Biden sink or swim. And I do think that's an open question, frankly, which one it's going to be, even though you'll be in this such a much more calm environment, as it were. And it won't be challenged nearly as much. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the moderator in this instance. But I want to go back and just want to look at this, because this is going to be important going forward, I think. There was one other possible intervening event that could have taken place that would have in some way said, okay, You have these people who ran for president all saying that Joe Biden's okay. Elizabeth Warren could have jumped in and said, I think Bernie Sanders can be president. And she didn't do that. What's your sense of like why that happened and what the implications are going to be going forward?
I mean, so I think you can, you know, you can really approach this from two different directions, but I think it's probably most useful to start on the Sanders side. So if you walk it backwards and you say, what would have been the absolute ideal moment for Elizabeth Warren to endorse Bernie Sanders? You know, forget the question of getting her to endorse. Let, you know, you start with the assumption that, you know, these are the two progressives in the candidate in the race, and they're fighting against the moderate wing, and that they're trying to make sure that one of them wins. And to me, it's probably Monday after Nevada in South Carolina, you rally together, and you know, you create a couple of days of narrative in the media of that furthers, you know, the idea that Sanders is kind of the inevitable nominee. Because Sunday night was when the 60 Minutes piece ran that had Sanders talking about Castro. Instead of doing a couple of days talking about Castro and having a fight, well, Biden, you know, Obama said the same thing about Castro,
right?
And they did improve literacy, but you know, fine, all that. Instead of having a few days of talking about Castro, which then leads into Jim Clyburn endorsing Biden by the end of the week, if you could have had Warren and Sanders crisscrossing South Carolina with AOC, which, as we've seen, she was reluctant to really get out on the campaign trail, pulling together that the movement and making the case that, like, look, this is the energy that you saw in Nevada, this like broad multiracial working class movement, is now combining with the remnants of Elizabeth Warren's suburban coalition, and it's going to drive forward. Maybe at that point, Jim Clyburn worries that endorsing Biden isn't the thing to do. The exact same way that the Culinary Union desperately wanted to endorse Joe Biden, but was so nervous about his electability that they held off. Mm. And they obviously sent signals that they didn't like Sanders, and that they did like Joe Biden. But their membership went wildly for Sanders, as they stayed out of it. So maybe that staves off the stampede that we saw. But then, how do you make that happen? First of all, you need to not have had such a toxic January between January and February between Warren and Sanders. You know, the dinner gate, what did Bernie Sanders say precisely about whether or not a woman could beat Trump in 2020? They're just, that didn't need to be as toxic as it got. Warren, of course, bears responsibility for having been the initial leaker of it. She's the one who, and I reported this in The Intercept, she told, after she met with Bernie, she had an off the record dinner with a bunch of journalists. I was not among them, but she said it. She told that story at that dinner, and so that's how the story, percolated out into the rumor mill.
It was an off the record dinner, just to be clear, right? I mean,
right, off the record dinner. But these journalists are all friends, and they don't have the same kind of respect for an off the record dinner that Bob Woodward might have for, the identity of Deep Throat.
Right. Right.
And so they're out at the bar later and they tell their spouses, who are also journalists, and those, and then, at some point enough people learn that those people are no longer, they were not at the dinner. So they're not bound by the off the record. MJ Lee, the CNN reporter who published the story, you know, had said that she was working on that story for months. And by working on a story for months, a reporter like MJ doesn't mean that it was all she was doing all day.
Right.
You know, for months. But like that she'd heard about it months earlier. And, you know, every chance you get, you bounce it off somebody else to see if you can get another source.
Right. All you're doing is you're basically saying, like, will you at least, like, will you say it to me off the record? And will you,
right,
you know, like,
right,
or will you say it anonymously? No, I don't feel comfortable
right
doing that. You know what? It's 6 weeks later. Hey, Bill, it's me. I just wanted to, you know, check in, see how you're doing, see if there's any interest in, you know, that type of thing.
Right. And you say, now I have three other people who are saying, you know, can you be a fourth person?
Right.
And it's like, okay, sure, I can be a fourth person.
But
so at that point, it's like, who cares?
But to me, it wasn't the leak, because I remember talking about that story when it came out. And then subsequent to that leak, the Sanders campaign denied it. And I think that their perspective was like, she's not going to confirm this. Like, it seems to me the play, if you're Elizabeth
right
Warren and you're still, you know, you're in it, is you come out and you say, I don't talk about what I talk about in private with what someone says to me in private. I don't go to the press
right
about that. So no comment, because I don't ever talk about what I said in private. And then she
right
gets the benefit, if there was any benefit, to the fact that it leaked out from other people. I don't think that was their plan. But I don't know why she couldn't just go out and say, like, I'm not talking about it. Like, you know, people were like, why would
right
she lie for Bernie? That's not lying. That's her saying, I don't talk about private conversations. And then
right
she gets the credit of, like, defending that private conversation on some level. But
right.
But and I think that was a
right
mistake that the campaign made, you know, and maybe she was upset about, you know, the campaign coming out and denying that Bernie said it. And, you know, who knows what was said and how it was expressed, but it was a, you know, like after Warren dropped out, Joe Rossbers was saying it, right? I mean, Joe Rossbers was going on Twitter, her campaign,
right,
saying like she couldn't win because of misogyny. Well, I mean, you just like were making hay out of Bernie Sanders supposedly saying that 2 years ago. I don't understand how you like you should go and sign up Bernie Sanders as an advisor to you next time, Joe Rossbers, because apparently he knows something that it took you 2 years to find out. But putting that aside, the failure of them on a personal level, like that's all well and good. And I think like I think I cannot tell you how many people who are sort of normies who, you know, were supportive of both Warren and Sanders. And, you know, I don't have a very wide circle of people that I know, period. But the number of people who contacted me and said, how could this just be about, like, these two people not getting along? like, I don't think people who don't work in politics sort of, like, can fathom that she would not have endorsed him because they weren't getting along personally.
Well, it's tied up in their view of each other as well. And I think it's worth, you know, dinging Sanders, too, for their response. Like there was also an easy response of, look, that's not what I meant. What I meant is that Trump will weaponize misogyny
right
against any woman who runs. But obviously, Hillary Clinton won in 2016. And I believe that a woman could win if that's how my friend Elizabeth Warren understood what I said. I just want to be clear that that's not what I meant, and
right.
I, you know, but move on.
Right.
Like,
they tried to do that after the fact, but they did it too late.
Yeah. Right. And instead, they kind of got into this huge fight over what exactly they said, etc. But yes. So. They were always described as friends. That's just not true. Like they're not friends. And you know, Warren, as she started saying publicly toward the end, you know, just doesn't think that Sanders is an effective politician. She understands him as the guy he was from 2009 to 2015. When she was involved in Senate politics, and that wasn't his you know, that wasn't his shining moment. Like he had done more impressive things than other times in his career. And so she just kind of understood him as that. And she started being more upfront about that, but that's real. Like she didn't have a ton of respect for his effectiveness as a politician. She also really, did take seriously the stuff that, she talked about with Rachel Maddow, about the online, attacks and,
right.
And did seem to genuinely feel like that the Sanders campaign, Sanders supporters are worse, and that the Sanders team didn't do enough to stop it, or, maybe even encouraged it. And so that kind of like that really soured the relationship there.
What do you make of the idea, however, I mean, like, that there's also putting all that aside. And I think for sort of normies, they just like can't wrap their head around the idea that,
right.
That like, wait a second. Okay. So he's a jerk. And in the past he wasn't effective as a senator, but you are so passionate about these issues. Like, okay, he wants to have, debt-free college and get rid of all debt for college students. And you want to just get rid of 95% of it. And granted, like, he wants to do it in a way that, you know, expresses an ideology that's different from hers on some level. You know, the where you land on these specific issues may be similar, but, you know, there's a structure to it that may make for other outcomes that are different. All well and good. But I think, like, normies don't understand that nuance. And by normies, I mean, like, 80% of the people, 90% right. of the people. And they're just like, what? How does the fact that he's a jerk keep you from supporting like the ability for this thing to actually come to fruition? And I guess my question is at this point, what, like, you know, I was talking to Weigel about this on Super Tuesday, and we were previewing it, and he said that he thought, I think it was Super Tuesday, maybe it was last Tuesday, I can't even remember anymore. He said that she was operating under the same theory that last time she was able to get stuff out of Clinton concessions because she had stayed on the sidelines. But it seems to me the reason why she was able to get concessions out of Clinton was because at that time, the assumption was by everybody that her base of support was essentially a Venn diagram that overlaid almost perfectly on Sanders' support. And so in some ways, like, you know, his support was her support because that was not tested. Now, in this instance, it seems like she in what army? Like, she's right. not like she has basically alienated herself from all the people who had her number two behind Sanders, which was a lot of Sanders voters. And right. all of her number ones are already now with Biden. Like, what leverage does she have?
Yeah, that's the exact argument that I made in a piece I did for The Intercept. That's
where I get all my ideas.
You know, even in 2016, she had if she had endorsed Sanders, she'd have had a little extra oomph that she could have brought over to the Clinton campaign and extracted concessions for, because she could deliver even more,
right?
Because she would have had more credibility. But you're right, like, because it hadn't been tested, she still had a lot of that value. But now that it's been tested, what exactly is she going to be able to deliver? You know, the 9-10% that she had left largely went to Biden after she dropped out. So if Biden already has the 9-10% that she was collecting toward the end, then why does he need her? What does she bring? Now, one of the things that she was clearly thinking about when she didn't endorse was what would the reaction have been of that remaining 9%, 10% to that endorsement. And, you know, I got a taste of it just when I wrote my piece arguing for why she should endorse. And I, you know, sent it out to my email newsletter that has a lot of Warren supporters on it. There's lots of Bernie people, Warren, Pete, Biden. There, you know, it's a diverse range of supporters. But the Warren people wrote back, you know, F him. You know, they were livid at the very idea that that Warren would endorse Bernie Sanders, even as I had framed the argument that it was better for her to do.
Right.
Because it builds her power. Like, you know, aside from what you want for Bernie Sanders, it builds her power to be able to then, you know, win the trust back of that wing of the party so that she can then flex her muscle against people like Biden. Without having the muscle, she can't flex it. But yeah, there was a lot of anger, and there's no doubt that Warren was hearing from many, many people, both people close to her, but also like just the broad, you know, supporter base that she had remaining when she dropped out of the race, that she absolutely should not endorse Sanders. Now, I would argue that you pile drive right through that.
Right.
Because you're going to be able to win those people back.
Of course.
Much more easily down the road than you can win back the Sanders people who you may have lost for good.
On some level, that whole drama that you've just worked out, right, that the calculus, that to me just seems like, I mean, it seems, I don't know, it seems fairly, let me put it this way. I have not heard, I've not been reading, you know, somebody else email blast that makes a compelling counter argument, right? Like no one seems to be making, I haven't heard anybody from the Warren camp make the compelling counter argument. I don't even think they've attempted, never mind compelling. I have not seen it other than F that guy. And it seems to me that is indicative of what was in some way problematic with the entire Warren attempt at winning, was that there was just not an appreciation. Because you and I think, like, you know, you, I know you, my sense is that you started this campaign sort of like, you know, very, that you were a Warren person, or at the very least that you had watched what she had done with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And, you know, this is someone who is incredibly adept at making arguments that compel within sort of like politics as it exists within institutions, right? Probably, I imagine, right, at Harvard Law School, she probably did the same thing. I know there was a lot of politics there within that law school. And right, and she did the same thing within the government. But it seems to me that there was just almost a complete absence of appreciation that a politician's power comes from having a broad constituency, just in terms of sheer numbers. And like that just seems to be absent from the calculation. And like nobody has said to her, you in what army? It's always been like, that's a good argument. You win. But in this type of politics, you need the army too.
Which is so strange, because the way that she first went after Tim Geithner as head of the Congressional Oversight Panel was by ginning up, you know, public outrage through her, you know, viral interrogations of him.
Yep.
Then the way she got the CFPB through was famously saying, you know, I either want a strong CFPB or I want blood and teeth on the Senate floor. And by blood and teeth on the Senate floor, what she meant was whipping up the unions and the blogosphere and the outside progressive groups that were championing the CFPB. And every time that Chris Dodd or Barney, anybody else would try to weaken the CFPB, you know, she would go public and she would rally all kinds of populist outrage. The Senate would get flooded with phone calls and they would back off the whatever moderation they were trying to like seep into the CFPB. And so, you know, that was her very explicit strategy to get the CFPB through, was to leverage this outside power. So that's what's so bizarre about your point, which is right. she understands that it's not just her, it's her and her army that were able to get it done. Maybe there's been some rewriting in her mind that it was more of an internal fight. Maybe she thinks that the Sanders army was just never with her and never would be with her, which would be a misreading of it. So it's hard to square, because, you know, if she had merely been kind of an inside player in the, you know, fighting out the academic politics all the way to the presidential level, that would be understandable. But she really did leverage outside power when she was pushing for the CFPB, and also after she became a senator. She was very conscious in trying to meet kind of every progressive activist and writer who had a platform and a social base that could be, you know, then utilized, you know, in the service of, you know, whatever agenda she was pushing. But that was just that was abandoned in the last, you know, month.
Yeah,
and saying like, yeah.
And I think it's a huge loss to the progressive movement. You know, like she came out with she put out a video the other day, I think, about you know, a plan to deal with coronavirus, the C word, as we're saying around here,
mm-hmm.
so we don't get demonetized. Mm-hmm. And I can't, I saw that and I was like, it didn't make really much of a ripple, and understandable on some level, but I can't help but imagine the sort of like the parallel universe where she had endorsed Sanders, the race could still be exactly where it is, and that thing would have been everywhere, right? Like, you know, like,
yeah, right.
I mean, it would have been. And now this may be, people might be saying like, well, that's sort of like a petty, narrow example, and it may be meaningless, but I don't think it is. I mean, I think that like that would have been indicative of, you know, I feel like that would be everywhere now. Had she endorsed Sanders, and whether he was walking away with the primary or whether he was exactly as positioned as where he is now, right? I mean, it would have been just like subsumed by the Borg, and, you know, she would have been simultaneously lifted up. I mean, I just, the things I heard about, like, you can't ask her to save Bernie's ass, you know, now that he's in trouble. And it's like, what? Like, you know, it's like, this is right. Not like Bernie Sanders' career, you know, it's like, this is not, it seems like it was a fundamental misunderstanding of like, this is not about Bernie's career. You know, I think for his supporters, right. For the most part, I mean, maybe some, but I mean, I don't think people are like, finally, Sanders is going to get his due as president. Like, I don't care. I'm more interested right. in like, I'm more interested in debt-free college, or, you know, whatever it is,
yeah.
You know, free college. But we can leave that there, because that is, you know, and I think, you know, time will tell. Maybe she can rebuild that. I'm not sure where, frankly, because these things,
right.
you know, I think
not going to come from the Klobuchar people.
Exactly. I just don't know where that's going to come from. And I think the failure for them to recognize that was also indicative of what they failed to do during the campaign. Frankly, they were constantly
right.
listening to, you know, a narrow set of people instead of like seeing where the broad sort of like currents were. All right. So lastly, let's talk about this. Just Sanders goes into this debate. I think, tell me if you think you've heard anything or have any sense that's going to be wrong. He's going to make his case, probably by bringing in a lot of what's going on with the C word right now, for a broader sort of social democratic, you know, vision of what America could be. Biden's going to go out there and say, you know, a combination of some platitudes and some narrowly tailored, we need to address these things. And Donald Trump's not the guy to do it. What happens on Tuesday? I mean, if none of this was going on, I would say, like, there's no reason to believe he's going to do better in Arizona. There's no reason to believe he's going to do better in Florida. No reason to believe he's going to do better in Illinois or Ohio. But I don't know, like, the
right.
electorate
right.
that comes out now is going to be, could very well be very, very different. I mean, Bernie Sanders wins overwhelmingly under the age of 45. He loses overwhelmingly over the age of 45. And if I had to predict who's going to come out in this environment, I would say one or the other. I don't know.
But what's fascinating, and this, we don't have surveys or anything on this yet, so this is more impressionistic, but paradoxically, it appears to me that people under 45 are taking the C word much more seriously than people over 45, who just to generalize, seem to have an attitude of, you know, let's party. Like, this is, you know, we've been through all kinds of scares. This is just the media ginning stuff up. We're going to be fine. Whereas people under 45 are thinking, you know what, I'm probably personally going to be fine because even if I get it, you know, I'll survive it because I'm not in the high risk category, which may or may not be true. We'll see.
Right.
Don't go banking on that.
Right.
But I should be careful because I don't want to infect older people. So it's this bizarre situation where younger people are taking it more seriously on behalf of older people who themselves are not taking it seriously. So while you would think just from common sense that the effect of the pandemic would be that older people would stay home, and younger people would go out to the polls, it might actually end up being the opposite. You know,
Do you think that's a function of social media? Do you think that's a function because
function of what?
Do you think that's a function of social media? Because younger people tend to be on social media, so they're seeing, like, I haven't spoken to anybody under the age of 50 who cannot recite that you know, those two threads from the Italian doctors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where they talk about, like, we're having to make decisions now on who to intubate and who not, and, you know, in terms of, like, who gets the respirators and who don't. You know, and if you look at the legacy media, right? I mean, if you look at Fox, it's like, folks, you know, this is ridiculous. We are a country of huggers.
The flu.
We're a country of huggers. And if you're not hugging, you're really fundamentally, you know, letting the terrorists win or something. And, you know,
The foreign virus win.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a handshaker. And if you can't shake hands, there's no point in, you know, in being an American or whatever it is. And I mean, I just wonder, I mean, and if that's the case, I wonder how savvy both Biden and Sanders will be about this on Sunday, because presumably, right, like, all those primary goers are going to be tuning into that. And if like they get out the message that is really the actual message, like, you know, that, like, hey, wait a second, you know, older people really need to be creating some social distance right now. I wonder if that's going to end up impacting the electorate. I mean, these are all questions that who knows. And then, I mean, just to take it a step further, let's say that, you know, the turnout in Florida is like half of what we've seen relative to other places. And in Arizona is half of what we've seen in other places. And Illinois is 2/3 of what we've seen in other places, right? In terms of, like, how we would extrapolate.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, the numbers of people under the age of 40, instead of representing, you know, 40% of the electorate, end up representing 65% of the electorate.
Mm-hmm.
Sanders gets back into the campaign. I'm just, you know, throwing out a scenario here. I don't know that it's likely, but I mean, you know, I from day to day, I can't tell you what's likely on anything.
Well, they would end the primary.
You think
that night?
You think they would shut it down?
Yeah, they'd be like, wait a minute, we're not, because they'd say this is not fair.
Right.
You know, Sanders just won these four states in landslides. He didn't deserve to. He only won because these irresponsible people came out and voted and the responsible old folks stayed home. So, yeah, this doesn't count. Well, Biden's the nominee.
Right.
And they would find some way to make that be the case. If the scenario that you described is the one that unfolds. But I think your point about social media is really insightful and might be explaining a large degree of what we're witnessing with the disparate reactions to the crisis that old people just, they don't get it yet.
Right. And because
maybe they will by Tuesday though.
Right. And
you know, that exponential function is at work.
If that scenario, which I've just outlined, and I think like, you know, that has, I don't know, we can say, let's say it has a 5% chance of happening, which is,
yeah.
you know, basically, let's say, yeah, let's say, but let's say 5%, because it seems like 5% comes in a lot these days, right?
Yes, it sure does.
And
a lot less
and,
comes in a lot.
And I think the reaction will be exactly like you're saying. And man, oh man.
How do you operationalize that?
The best scenario for Democrats under that is that like there's no physical convention, right? Because mm-hmm. I mean, I just think things are going to get super messy. All right, let's just very briefly, because I feel really strongly. I've interviewed. I think I may have interviewed both of these candidates. Ohio, there is a congressional primary that's really important. Megan Harper interviewed. Mm-hmm. We played
Morgan.
Her, right? Morgan Harper, rather. And we played that interview, right, over vacation. People can go back, find it over our vacation week. I did that for Ring of Fire. She is an excellent candidate. Tell us just about Harper and then this challenge to Lipinski in Illinois.
Yeah, Harper, so she was a foster child in Columbus, Ohio, raised there. She actually already has one accomplishment under her belt. She's the candidate, if you remember, that ended up getting that New York Times editor demoted. Jonathan Weissman. You remember when Justice Democrats endorsed Morgan Harper, he tweeted something like, interesting, Justice Democrats endorsing against an African-American female incumbent, who's Joyce Beatty, who she's challenging. And she tweeted, Jonathan, I'm black too. And he tweeted something like, I know, I saw your picture, or something very weird, and then got himself demoted. So like one day long Twitter scandal. So she worked at the CFPB at a pretty high level. And then moved back to Columbus and is running with, you know, kind of the support of all the left factions in the party. And it's a huge symbolic race, because the Congressional Black Caucus, ever since Joe Crowley lost, has been panicking over the possibility that these DSA style folks who are able to cobble together a working class coalition with gentrifiers are going to kind of remake the urban map for congressional races. And so far that hasn't happened to any CBC members yet. They've all survived whatever challenges they've gotten, but this is the biggest threat so far. Joyce Beatty's a huge player in Columbus. Her husband was a top state senator for 20 years. She was then appointed to his seat. She rose to become minority leader. She's been in Congress since 2012, and has, you know, she's not remotely as kind of repulsive to the left as somebody like Dan Lipinski. Like Dan Lipinski openly like anti-immigrants, anti-gay, anti-choice, like pushed back against $15 minimum wage, like just across the board, kind of an outlier in the new kind of more progressive House Democratic caucus. Whereas Joyce Beatty is much more in line with, if you look at her voting record, it's going to be pretty consistently, you know, with the rest of the Democratic caucus. Though she serves on the House Financial Services Committee,
right?
She's been friendly to a lot of financial institutions. She takes a lot of corporate PAC money. You know, she's a very standard Democrat in that way, and so that's why it's such a threat. Because for decades, if you were a standard Democrat, you were fine. That's good enough. Your seat's not going to be at risk. If Morgan Harper is able to beat her, then it tells all these other standard Democrats that this way that you've been doing business, you know, voting with the party on, mostly major issues, but being pretty corporate friendly along the way, isn't going to fly anymore, or at least it comes with some risk that you're going to have to take in.
Exactly.
In from the left.
That'll send a message to people like Gregory Meeks in Queens here. He's got a challenger, Sean Chattery, who I interviewed incidentally recently too. There's more in the Congressional Black Caucus of folks like that. Standard Democrats who basically, have been flying under the radar as being corporate. I mean, Meeks has been, like this for, I just remember this from like 10 years ago going like, wait, what? This guy's, and there's been a lot of that. Like, he's taking big money. How is that possible based upon, particularly, 10, 15 years ago, Queens was not gentrified to the extent that it is now. And, you start to realize like, well, he does this because he doesn't get challenged. And nobody, the voters just aren't aware of it. I'm barely aware of it. And so this is going to, that race in Ohio is going to be a big deal. And again, we're going to see this, I don't know how this whole dynamic is going to be impacted. But those are two races we're going to be paying attention to.
Right. And she was counting on a lot of student support. And now OSU has been shut down. Mm. And so has the local community college. And so has the Lutheran college in the district. So, that's really going to cut the legs out from under her campaign. At the same time, they moved a bunch of polling places out of senior centers to protect seniors, which is public health, a great thing to do. You don't want people traipsing through senior centers, but now, are those seniors going to be able to vote? So it really, who knows? Like, it's a total wild card. What's going to happen on Tuesday?
Ryan Grimm, I held you for a long time. I know that upset your son, and tell him, my son is extremely pissed at me. Every Tuesday night now, I have to pretend like I am a fan of Jim Carrey movies just to get him to go to bed as we cover the primary. So tell your son this.
Oh, it's hard for them to understand that you're working. They don't understand this working from home thing. You're at home.
No, exactly. Well, I will be soon. And he was pissed because I would just like go out on Tuesday nights to do coverage of the primaries. So I had to start sending him codes on YouTube just to get him to go to bed. I had to promise him, like, I know he's not watching now, but I had to promise him to work in the word ace because he is a huge fan of Ace Ventura. And
that's a good movie.
That's not a good movie. Ryan Grimm, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
See you later.
All right, bye. That's honestly like been the hardest thing about this primary season is to have to come to grips and indulge my son's like obsession with Jim Carrey.
That's the hardest thing?
That's been the hardest thing.
Interesting.
It's been really difficult. Like, Jim Carrey, he's my favorite. He's really funny. Have you ever seen The Mask? You've told me that.
Dumb and Dumber is a very funny movie.
I sat through Dumb and Dumber again with him. He's watched The Mask now like six times, for the life of me, I cannot.
Oh, yeah.
I just can't.
How old is he, six?
He's seven now. He just turned seven.
I loved The Mask when I was that age. That is the funniest movie when you're a little kid.
what's the thing he says, like... he says, say something nice to me. All right, Saul, you're a nice guy. Thank you very much. And I just, like, everything.
Those were memes for, like, us as seven-year-olds.
I can't tell you.
Smokey.
Yeah.
Look, Ma, I'm roadkill.
I'll tell you something. When he says this stuff to me, which he has said all those things, literally, like, inside of me, like, a part of me dies. Like, a part of me dies because I just... I can watch The Truman Show. I like The Truman Show.
Good movie.
I even had to go out and see Sonic the Hedgehog, where Carrie is. We had to go see that.
Wow,
the first...
he likes all of it.
He's a Carrie completionist.
He goes, you know how many movies Jim Carrey's done? I'm like, too many. And he's like, 56. And I'm going to see all 56.
You can work him down a better path, though, with a few of those,
I want to hear
like.
His performance in Man on the Moon's not bad.
Yes, I could show him the, you know,
number
what?
23.
And then you could get him into Andy Kaufman.
Don't like that movie.
Yeah, no, I know. It's, the movie itself's not that great, but his performance is good.
I auditioned with Milos Forman for that, did I tell you?
That's cool.
I went to his, and I think Andy Kaufman's brother got the part that I was going for.
Oh, yeah.
Son of a bitch. Could have been a different, could have been somebody.
I want Saul's review of number 23.
What's that? Is that the...
It's the one, it's not a comedy, it's one where Jim Carrey plays a guy that starts to see the number 23 everywhere.
He's like a schizophrenic paranoia. Yeah.
And is it also one where he's like in a phone booth the whole time, I think, if I remember that one, like where, I can't remember, like the whole movie is like him in a phone booth or...
That's interesting.
Or something like that. Yeah, no, there's a bunch of darker movies. The darker ones I appreciate more. It's just that like, that smoking and spank you very much, it's like... You know, I could watch Three Stooges all day. I will get him into, you know, I can't wait to show him The Jerk. Mm-hmm. And he's like, he likes Steve Martin's Pink Panther. But just like, I can't wait until he's old enough to understand that, like, how much respect I've lost for him because of this Jim Carrey obsession.
Somebody stop me.
Oh, God. I'm waiting for that day where I can just say, Saul, it's time you and I had the talk.
You don't feel slightly responsible because this was your industry. This was like kind of your peak back then too. You don't feel like you're paying
on that. That's why
I
hated
now.
Him so much. I was like, I was really into comedy at that time. And I was just like, oh, him on In Living Color. I was just like, this is bad. This is bad for everything I care about. And, I know my ex introduced him to Jim Carrey. I would have, if it were up to me, he would have been like 22 and someone would have said, have you ever seen that? You ever remember a Jim Carrey? And he would have been like, nope, never heard of him. But
well, you should definitely avoid the Netflix documentary where Jim Carrey just sits straight to camera and talks about when he played Andy Kaufman in Man on the Moon. And they just play the B-roll where he never leaves character or the behind the scenes footage.
Well, that I would be interested in seeing. I mean, to a certain extent, but if it's like that stuff, that drives me crazy.
P-A-R-T. Why? Because I gotta.
Nonsense! I say me the ball.
Oh boy.
There's a lot of good soundboards for Jim Carrey.
Yeah, make this into a members thing.
You know, if they shut down the schools, they shut down the schools, and I have a feeling that my ex is going to take Saul out shortly, and he's going to need something to do. Like maybe that's what I'll do. Like, hey man, do you want to do a Jim Carrey podcast?
Smoking.
All right, folks, we're going to have to shut the show down. We made it through the C word, but we're not going to make it through the other C word.
That's what you can do from home. Just launch Sam and Saul's Jim Carrey.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, exactly. Folks, just a reminder as we head into the fun half of the program, it's your support that makes this show possible. Are we going to try and do the experiment right now? No?
Yeah, no.
We'll do it Monday. This show relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free half, free of commercials. You get the fun half. Sometimes we get extra content. I'm going to, you know, depending on what happens going forward, we're going to have a little more time for that. Let me make one point clear, though. If you are going through, and we've had a number of cancellations, people are worried they're not going to be going in for work. They're not going to, not going to get paid. If you're one of those people, you can do one of two things. You can cancel and then send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and say, hey, I just canceled because I can't afford to be a member, but I want to still be, I still want access to the whole show. Give us some time because we, you know, everything's a little bit crazy, but we'll turn your access back on. And, you know, when you're out of any type of financial stuff, you can hook us back up then. If you're one of those people who don't have the means right now to support the program. You can do, you can just send us an email at Majority Reporters and have some patience, because it just, we dig through these things. We will hook you up with the full show. If you want to, you know, and then, you know, you can always do a one-off donation or whatnot, but the point is that no one will be locked out because of finances. You know, if you have to cancel, do not hesitate to do that. Send an email, and we will reinstate you as soon as possible. But we're going to go through some tough times, and people are going to be like not going into work, and, you know, having some extra entertainment is going to be something that they're, you know, that you're going to want. But again, I don't want anybody to go into any type of financial duress whatsoever. We will make it through here. That won't be a problem. We're not, you know, we're okay. You know, you know, there's always a little something here or there we can trim, and don't worry about that. So, we just don't want to lock anybody out for financial reasons. And so keep that in mind. If you are one of those people who are not feeling any financial pressure from this, you're not worried about it, and you thought about, you know, supporting the show in the past, now would be a good time. Join themajorityreport.com. Also, check out the Noma Key Show. You can go support her program over at patreon.com/ the Noma Key Show, or you can find her on YouTube. She's posting a lot of stuff these days. Started out, it was supposed to be like one show a week with like, you know, extras. And she's like, this is too much news. I have to. So good for her. And this week, TMBS was on Wednesday night. You can go to patreon.com.
Had a good discussion with Adolph Reed. People might like.
People might check that out. Patreon.com/TMBS or The Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Also, The Antifada. Check that out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada and a Literary Hangover.
Literary Hangover's plans have been changed because of self-quarantine things. One of the people on my show has a significant other in the medical field, so she's taken it very easy. So Alex and I, for tomorrow, will have a George Orwell episode on The Lion and the Unicorn, an essay he wrote during the war with Hitler. And it's kind of, people are talking about maybe Bernie Sanders should have ran as a New Deal Democrat instead of a Democratic Socialist and basically played to patriotism. Orwell has sort of a similar, I mean, it's a wartime propaganda, but he also has a similar critique of the left there too that I think speaks to the moment really well. So people check that out.
So wait, so what are you guys going to do? You're just going to do it over the phone?
Oh no, Alex is going to come in, but Grace won't be coming in. So.
But why can't she call in?
We're going to try to do that next week when things are more settled down. But, yeah, we needed to get one out for this weekend.
Her partner's in the medical field? And
yeah, basically. So, you know, we don't want to. I can't remember if he's been exposed yet or she just doesn't want to expose herself to maybe expose him. That
right.
Sort of stuff. So,
We're going to try in the coming days. And let me get this out there, too, actually. So that you can know it. There is a, I sent you that link, and it's in the, Brendan, where did I put that link? It is in the, here it is, flattenthecurve.com. This started out as a Google Doc, very similar to, you know, what happened with Indivisible. And I think actually somebody in, like, associated with Indivisible has availed this. Flattenthecurve.com. It is, as far as I can tell, like the best clearinghouse for advice and an understanding for what needs to happen and why. Scroll up just a little bit. You know, look, there's a lot of information out there. It's very hard to parse like what is accurate and what is not. But I think this is a pretty good place to start. Can you? Wow. Maybe too many people have gotten wind of it. And
yeah,
but, all right, so bookmark it for later, folks. flattenthecurve.com. I have it right here, and basically it there's a lot of stuff like And don't worry, people are watching me like wet my hands as I'm tearing this paper. My hands are super clean. I've been cleaning them quite a bit, and we've been rubbing down everything in this office. Believe me, it gives you a sense of like mortality rate by age. It is very low for people who are young, which is good. It's also very difficult to assess, you know, in any given place, because we don't know the full, we know the numerator, we don't know the denominator, or vice versa. And this is pretty extensive, but it's basically telling you about how to limit your risk. It's giving you advice about canceling non-essential travel. I was supposed to go out to LA this week, next week, to do a WTF. Oh, I gotta tell Maren I'm not coming. To do a podcast at Politicon, that thing that won't happen this year, is doing. And I just said, you know what? It's not that important that I could get stuck out there if there's some type of quarantine. We've been hearing rumors about that, but more importantly, like, you walk through areas where a bunch of people come from disparate areas. It's just like statistically, you're increasing the chance that that you're going to have problems. Keep your heat, your home clean. Develop routines. Like, this is something we've tried to institute in the office. As soon as you walk through the door, wash your hands, because you can wash your hands after, like, hey, I'm going to put my phone down and put this, and then all of a sudden you've contaminated everything. There's a lot of stuff, and you head over there. This is also good too. Symptoms. And we can't scroll down to it, but apparently if you're sneezing, not a symptom of the C word. If you have a runny or stuffy nose, very rare that it's a symptom of the C word. Diarrhea, rare that it's the C word. And it just gives you a comparison between the C word.
Is it just nausea, a cold, or what are the symptoms?
Nausea is not listed on the thing. Sorry.
Huh.
Who put this together?
This comes from the World Health Organization.
Heard of them.
Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So, sneezing, no. Just a definitive no. And listen, here's the other thing that is, and I don't know if it's in this piece, but I've been, you know, Hayes had had someone on. If you feel like you have symptoms, you do not go to the hospital. You call a doctor. You try and find some type of telemedicine. If you have a primary care doctor, you call them. You could call like the local, you know, urgent care or one of those, like, sort of like, you don't walk into the hospital unless you absolutely have no other recourse. And if you do, it may even be better to like go with someone else and have them walk into the emergency room and tell the nurse and the doctor, like, how do we start with, you know, here's the situation. What do we do? They may send you home and say, wait. Keep us updated, but maybe they can give you a name of somebody to call, because the idea is that you don't want to spread it if you do have it. Like, this is one of those scenarios where it's just like every action you take has implications, a tiny, tiny sliver for like huge numbers of people. And so no better chance than now to exhibit your communitarian impulses.
That's what happened to me back in the swine flu thing in 2009. I got sick during that, and I went to the on-campus sort of health center, and they're just like, go home. We're not going to test you. Like, if you have it, you have it. Just go home and quarantine yourself, basically.
And, you know, if you're sick, I mean, you get the rest anyways. And the one upshot about what's everything's going on now, it's like one of those scenarios where it's like you go home and rest. You're not missing anything. This is like a snow day for everybody. All right, see you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.